Okay, here we go. This is it. We're finally embarking on the long road to reform. At the dawn of the 13th century, with Pope Innocent III, you'd have to say that the papacy really reached its zenith. The Dominicans and the Franciscans had been carrying the gospel far and wide, new universities were hotbeds of theological enterprise, and the towering spires of Gothic cathedrals seemed to defy the law of gravity. Europe was united under Pope and Emperor, in theory at least. Because the Crusaders had taken Constantinople, the breach between East and West seemed to have finally been sealed. It looked like Christendom was, well, about to enter a golden age. And as is often the case, looks can be deceiving. These were. By 1261, the West's influence in Constantinople was over, as was that bogus union that the Fourth Crusade seemed to have forged between the Roman and Orthodox churches. Over the next two centuries, Europe saw several changes that set the scene for the modern world. One of the most important was in the realm of economics. You know, when we think of the Middle Ages in Europe, we remember feudalism with its strict rules of class. There was the land-owning nobility and the commoners, known as serfs, who worked the land for the nobles in exchange for protection. Now, we don't have time to go into it, but feudalism was largely the result of the developments in the technology of warfare. Armored warriors, called knights, were expensive. It took a vast economic base to field them. So serfs worked lands in exchange for protection by knights. These serfs gave loyalty, which was called fealty, to nobles in ever higher levels of authority, from counts and barons to dukes and earls, with the king, of course, at the top. A third class in this tiered structure of medieval society were the clergy. The church also owned lands and had serfs who worked for them. This made priests and abbots responsible for the secular rule of the church and monastery estates. But toward the end of the Middle Ages, the cities of Europe began to grow, and a new class of commoner emerged, the merchant. There were several reasons for the proliferation of merchants and the growth of villages into towns and towns into cities. One of the most important was the boom in trade. You see, the Crusades had stimulated Europe's taste for new things. Someone needed to buy up what Europe produced, which was a lot of wool, and take it to the East, where all the goodies were. Increased trade meant increased wealth for the merchants, who weren't landowners, but who did buy themselves nice homes in the now growing cities. Those houses needed furniture and art and all the other luxuries that mark a successful merchant. And so industries popped up to supply those wants, bringing even more people to the cities. New credit systems were developed as extra money meant people looking to invest for a profit. And slowly but surely, a new social class developed, the middle class, who didn't fit the strict feudal class structure that had dominated Europe for several hundred years. When nobles began taxing the trade crossing their land, the merchants protested and called for a stronger central government that would rein in these nobles. A king could protect trade, quash the bandits that harassed caravans, establish a common currency, and put an end to petty conflicts that disrupted trade. Kings saw the merchants and emerging middle class that supported them as a way to do, well, kind of an end run around the nobles who so often gave them grief. Kings didn't have to depend now on those nobles to supply knights and men-at-arms. From the taxes raised from the middle class, they could field their own army. The growth of strong kings during the late Middle Ages in Europe, it goes hand in hand with the rising middle class. And it's out of this process that the modern nations of Europe emerged. Regions that shared a common language and culture coalesced around strong central governments. And as a result, nationalism became one of the factors that would lead to problems for the church. Until the 13th century, Europeans identified themselves by their town, their city, their county. By the 15th century, they identified themselves as English, French, Swedish, and so on. Now, where this emerging nationalism affected the church was when a pope leaned in his policies towards this nation or that. When he did, that nation or this ignored his rule. This then led to the overall denigration of the pope's office and authority. That, in turn, led to not a few looking to someone other than the pope to lead in the much-needed reforms of the church. What's often neglected in a discussion of the roots of the Reformation is the impact of the Hundred Years' War on church history. lasting almost 140 years, from 1337 to 1475, the war dragged in almost all of Europe at one point or another. Basically, a conflict between France and England, it lasted so long and was filled with such intrigue that everyone seemed to want to weigh in at some point and take a few swipes at the other guy. It was during the Hundred Years' War that a French teenager named Joan had visions that stirred her countrymen to rally behind the French prince and give the British a good run for their money. Actually, money was the perennial British problem in the war. They would win amazing victories on the battlefield at places like Crecy and Agincourt, and then have to withdraw for lack of funds. And this long conflict with all of its many chapters had enormous consequences for the church. It was during this time that the so-called Babylonian captivity of the papacy took place, with the popes relocating from Rome to the French city of Avignon. But popes were puppets of the French throne, so the English disregarded the papacy. And then during the Great Papal Schism, when two rival popes vied for control of the church, Europeans aligned under whichever pope supported their cause in the war. That made putting the schism to an end even more difficult. All of this, of course, weakened the claims of the pope to universal authority. And what are we to say of the plague that devastated whole regions of the continent at this time? The little ice age of the 14th century set crop yields back and led to famine in many places. That, in turn, shattered the fragile economy and set those already living hand-to-mouth into a physically vulnerable position. Their immune systems were degraded, so when the plague arrived, hundreds of thousands were even more susceptible to its ravages. Between 1348 and 50, the Black Death swept Europe. While numbers vary, with a general account of a third of Europeans dying, there were some regions where as much as half the population succumbed. Think about what that did to the social fabric of those places. Imagine what it'd be like living where you do with only half the people. Now, for those in urban centers, that may sound like a dream come true at first. But realize, half of those who die are the only ones with the knowledge or the skill to do a good part of the work that keeps the system running. Half the houses are empty, half the stores closed. You get the idea. The plague sent a shockwave through the collective consciousness of Europe. How could a society so dominated by Christianity have suffered such devastation? The thought took hold in not a few places that maybe the church had gone astray so badly that God's wrath was in evidence. Could the Black Death be his way of cleansing house? While life had always been precarious, death now hovered over all. Life became little more than preparation for the life after death. Pilgrimages to Rome and Jerusalem were sought after. The poor couldn't take such long journeys, of course, so they would go to a local holy spot. Trade in relics, boom, even though the Fourth Lateran Council tried to put a kibosh on it. In the mid-15th century, when it was clear that the Turks were determined to take Constantinople, the Byzantine emperors appealed to the West to help, even though the Fourth Crusade had been a colossal failure. In trade for assistance, the popes required the East to affirm their loyalty to Rome. Under threat of imminent demise, the East agreed to terms at the Council of Ferrara in 1439. But the pope wasn't able to persuade the knights and armies of Europe to go to the aid of Constantinople. In the East, many of the Christians there saw the emperors bowing to Rome as a capitulation to heresy. They refused to fight for him or his cause. In 1443, the patriarchs of Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem rejected the council's decisions and broke communion with Constantinople. In 1452, after more than 400 years of animosity, a Roman mass was celebrated in the Hagia Sophia in Constantinople. But the city's days were numbered. Just a year later, Mohammed II laid siege to the city. His new guns punched holes in those once impregnable walls. Emperor Constantine XI died defending the city. The great Hagia Sophia became a mosque, and the city was renamed Istanbul. It was King Philip IV of France who managed to wrap the papacy tightly around his finger. His long contest with Pope Boniface VIII is what helped lead to the Avignon Papacy and the Great Schism. The next pope was Benedict XI, a Dominican of genuine piety who sought to undo the acrimony that Boniface had stirred up across Italy and France. Despite Benedict's attempts at harmony, King Philip insisted on calling a council to condemn the acts of Boniface. Benedict refused to attend, as it would have been yet another denigration of papal authority at the hands of the French monarch. this wasn't enough for the conservatives, who regarded Benedict's attempts at reconciliation as giving away too much of papal mojo. He died after only a year as pope. A rumor spread that he'd been poisoned, both sides claiming that the other had done the deed. And by both sides, I mean those French cardinals who backed Philip and the Italian, German, and English cardinals who backed Rome. Except for those who didn't. Yeah, I know. It gets confusing. Well, welcome to church history. Through a clever bit of subterfuge, the French cardinals wrangled an agreement to elect Clement V. Clement seemed to be a neutral candidate when he'd in fact been scheming with the French all along. During his term as pope from 1305 to 14, he never visited Rome even once. He appointed 24 cardinals, all but one of them French, ensuring that the next several popes would also be French. Several of these cardinals were his relatives. While Clement V's papacy was abysmal, probably the most shameful moment was his consent to the destruction of the Templars. The Templars were one of the military orders founded during the Crusades, and since the Crusades were over, the Templars were in effect obsolete, but they were incredibly wealthy and powerful. This was at a time when King Philip was on a campaign to assert his absolute dominance over all of French nobility. He regarded the Templars as an obstacle to overcome, since they provided funds and arms to those very nobles that Philip wanted to subjugate. He also owed them a considerable sum in loans that he had taken from them. In a fascinating tale of intrigue, Philip persuaded others to do his dirty work for him. He had the Templars accused of disgusting crimes, besides the more pedantic evil of heresy. Under torture, some Templar leaders confessed, including their Grand Master Jacques de Molay. De Molay later recanted his confession, but it was too late. He and a companion were executed. The Templars were disbanded, their wealth confiscated. Can you guess by who? Yeah, the French crown. Now, we're going to pick it up at this point next time as we continue our journey on the long road to reform.